It's Monday, June 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Greece is poised for a default on its repayment to the International Monetary Fund. Is the West losing its campaign against the Islamic State? One analyst believes so, following last Friday's attacks in Tunisia and Kuwait.
These attacks both targeted the very core interests of two more Arab states.
And New York gets a taste of music from the city's Harlem Renaissance. It's all ahead. All eyes are on Greece today as banks remain closed and the country appears set to default on a $1.8 billion loan repayment to the International Monetary Fund. While the nation's economic future remained uncertain, the Greek finance ministry said it will open about 1,000 bank branches to allow pensioners, many of whom do not have ATM cards, to withdraw enough money to get through the week. And Greeks are set to vote July 5th in a referendum on a new round of European austerity measures, which Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras opposes. I'm joined by our Europe correspondent, Al Pessin, in London. Well, Al, we're coming up on the midnight Athens time deadline. At this moment, of course, things can fluctuate all around, but is a default likely?
A default looks likely at the moment, but there are fresh talks going on even as we speak. A new proposal was made late yesterday. There's some disagreement about whether this proposal is actually new or just a reiteration of the proposal the Greeks had already rejected, but talks are going on and it's possible there could be a solution.
Greek Prime Minister Tsipras says he will respect the outcome of Sunday's referendum. Are these reforms likely, and will Tsipras's party remain in power?
Well, Tsipras's party will remain in power unless it quits, and he suggested that it might do just that. He is opposed to accepting this deal, and he will urge the Greek people not to accept it in the referendum. And he's said that if they do accept it, as you mentioned, he will respect their choice, but his party will not implement it, is what he said.
As these talks are continuing today, are there any indications of any compromise between the sides?
Well, this has gone, I think, probably farther than either side expected or wanted it to go. Both are standing on principles that they believe in, and both are staring at some pretty serious consequences if they don't reach agreement. So it's very hard to predict where we go from here. But for Greece, if there is no resolution to this, and it doesn't have to be by midnight tonight, but if there's no resolution to this in the coming days, then Greece faces the prospect not only of technically being in default, which I think is widely expected anyway, but possibly of being forced out of the euro currency, which economists believe would cause a severe economic depression in Greece, even worse than the very serious situation they're facing today. And for European leaders, it would mean that that part of what's known around here as the European project has failed, had shown some weakness, and that other countries could potentially leave the euro, maybe even leave the European Union, and they don't want that. So both sides are playing a very tough game here, but in actual terms, Sarah, compared to the kinds of numbers of billions of euros that we've been dealing with over the last 5 years of this financial crisis, this is about a relatively small amount of money. But it's come down to the principles. Will Greece make further cuts? Will the international creditors give Greece further relief? And both sides, for the moment, are saying no.
Is it known? I understand you're in London, not in Athens, but is it known generally how the Greek people are looking at this? Or are they as divided as themselves?
Well, they are somewhat divided. Public opinion polls indicate that the majority do want to stay within the euro, as does the prime minister. But the question is, under what terms? And we won't really know the answer to that until they go to the ballot boxes on Sunday, if that referendum actually happens.
All right. Well, my thanks to Al Pessin in London. Well, joining me here now in the studio is social media Andrew Palchevsky with a look at what's trending. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, Greece is certainly one of the top trending topics. We have two hashtags in particular. Hashtag Grexit, or G-R-E-X-I-T, combining the words Greece and exit.
Right.
And then the same thing with referendum, combining Greece and referendum.
I haven't heard that one.
Yeah, that's the other one now that's starting to bubble up through the social media trends. But people taking to social media, talking about the implications, sharing different thoughts that people have. And it's interesting to see the variety of different languages to see how broadly this affects people. You're seeing a lot of people speaking in Greek on social media, but French, Italian, Spanish, English. Some of the English comments that I was reading this morning, people saying, tourists, if you go to Greece, definitely bring cash. Others saying they're hoping that this sparks new tourism and cheaper tourism going to Greece in the future. And then there was one crowdfunding campaign where someone said, if everybody in Europe gives €3, we can all bail out Greece together. So it was an interesting take on things, certainly. Another hashtag that's trending today, or another topic that's trending, is the leap second. Now,
I've heard of leap year, but...
Right, and I always say I wish I had more time in the day, as many people do, and well, we're going to get that today. So what's going to happen is usually... the clock will go from 23:59:59 to zero as it changes into the new day. Today, it's going from 23:59:59 to 23:59:60 and then into the new day. And the idea of this is that the Earth's rotation is slowing over a number of years, and so that necessitates the addition of an extra second to our calendar. It's managed by the International Earth Rotation and Reference System Service. And you think, you know, 1 second, that can't possibly make much of a difference. But it's actually very interesting because so many smartphones these days rely on syncing to the time and data that syncs with specific timing. So the second is actually very important for a lot of the smartphones that we use and a lot of the programs that we use in applications. So everyone taking to social media talking about what they want to do with their extra second. But it is, all kidding aside, actually pretty important. And then... kidding not aside, we have another story that's trending on social media this morning, speaking of smartphones. Siri, the Apple service that you can, you know, ask Siri questions and things. Someone found what they call an Easter egg, or a little kind of fun joke that they put into Siri. When you ask Siri, what is 0 divided by 0? Siri says, it doesn't make sense that, you know, 0 divided by 0 doesn't mean anything. And she says, using the example of the cookie monster from Sesame Street, she says, if you had 0 cookies and divided it among 0 friends, that wouldn't leave you with anything. She said, how many cookies would each person get? See, it doesn't make sense. Cookie monster is sad that there is no cookies, and you are sad that you have no friends. Aww. So people making jokes about that as that trends across social media this morning.
Okay. Oh, on that sad note. Well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palchevsky. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Did you ever wonder how parrots are able to closely mimic human speech?
What's up, angel carrot?
Parrots, along with songbirds and hummingbirds, are considered to be vocal learners, able to imitate many sounds, and parrots can also imitate human speech. An American, Dutch, and Danish team of scientists say that these type of birds have centers in their brains called cores that help control vocal learning. But they also find that the cores in a parrot's brain are surrounded by outer rings they call shells, which also help with vocal learning. The scientists find that the shells in the brains of birds known for mimicking human speech are comparatively bigger than those who don't have this ability. The research team says that their findings may also offer insight into the neural mechanisms of human speech. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, an opera from New York's Jazz Age. The Islamic State has claimed responsibility for a series of attacks in recent days that have killed and wounded dozens of Muslims and foreigners in Yemen, Kuwait, and Tunisia. The Washington Post, citing U.S. officials and counterterrorism experts, says the attacks were likely to intensify anxieties about the IS group's expanding reach. despite the Pentagon's claim that the IS group has lost about 25% of its territory in eastern Syria and northern Iraq. The Sunni militant group has been bolstered by foreign recruits and funding from oil sales, sponsors, criminal activity, and taxes. Meanwhile, Reuters, quoting officials and witnesses, says fighters loyal to the IS group have seized substantial territory in Afghanistan, resting land in eastern Nangarhar province held by rival Taliban insurgents. The Washington Post says the IS group is also expanding through stray followers and loyalists into countries like Libya, where security has deteriorated. James Jeffries, a former U.S. ambassador and now a regional analyst with the Washington Institute on Near East Policy, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the global war against the Islamic State is being lost.
We're losing it because we're not winning it. And I give you the example of Tunisia and Kuwait on Friday. It doesn't matter whether these were inspired by ISIS or actually planned by them. These attacks both targeted the very core interests of two more Arab states. Tunisia's tourist industry, that's its whole economy. In the case of Kuwait, and I've served in both countries, I know them well. In the case of Kuwait, it's the very delicate balance between the Shia minority and the Sunni majority. These ISIS people are smart. They're going to develop new ways to come at the rest of the Arab world, the Shia minority, and all the rest of us. And we're sitting there basically twiddling our thumbs, talking about training forces. We haven't lost one single soldier. I think it shows that we're not really in this fight.
The Pentagon on Monday marked the anniversary by saying we believe that we've had an impact. Despite the loss of a quarter of the land of the group seized in Syria and Iraq, however, they remain, the Pentagon admits, a potent force.
They're barely contained. They haven't been seriously degraded. They've been able to replace many of their losses, and they certainly haven't been destroyed.
British Prime Minister Cameron said, frankly, he thinks we, referring to the British people, are the target following that Tunisia attack that killed perhaps as many as 30 British tourists.
These are words and nothing but words. How many British combat soldiers are fighting in the front lines with the Kurds or with the Sunni tribes against ISIS? Politicians say this. Nobody wants to engage in the region because they're afraid of their own populations. They need to be told that ISIS is coming after them.
Well, at what point do you think there will be some sort of allied effort against IS? Will it take an attack on a Western target?
It'll take a whole series. It's a deep reluctance, particularly in Britain and the United States, stemming from Iraq and this feeling that the military achieves nothing in the Middle East. And having been on the ground for 3 years in Iraq, I can tell you the military cannot do very much to change the social makeup of a country. What it can do is destroy an army. ISIS is primarily an army. All of its juice, or 90% of it, comes from the fact that it holds its ground against a 61-state coalition. If we don't get smart on this thing, it's going to tip yet another country. It's going to tip yet another government. It's going to tip yet another important place. I don't know where.
Do you consider IS to be the biggest terror threat right now in the world?
Well, there's no doubt. It's a whole dimension bigger than Al-Qaeda ever was. It can take down countries. Al-Qaeda never had that capability.
Former Ambassador James Jeffries, the Associated Press, marking the one-year anniversary of the proclamation of the Islamic Caliphate in Syria and Iraq, quoted survivors of IS occupation of the Iraqi village of Eski Mosul, now under Kurdish control, as a seven-month reign of terror coupled with despair over a lack of outside support to help them rise up against IS. Victor Beatty asked RAND Corporation senior political scientist Rick Brennan about that.
The international community has not, by and large, provided the type of assistance to these people who are being assaulted. If you go back to the how much agony it was before the United States took effort to protect the Yazidis when they were being decimated. But in every one of these towns and villages where ISIS is in charge, that same type of horrific extermination of people who don't believe in this radical view of Islam is taking place. And the world is looking the other way. And I think that much like the world looked the other way when the Jews were being attacked prior to World War II, the United States, the international community, really needs to look at what this organization is doing and what it means for not only the people, but also the culture of that entire region.
referring to the attack on mostly British tourists in Tunisia. The British Prime Minister said on Monday that we, referring to Britain, are the target. Is that what it's going to take to mount a major offensive against IS? Will be an attack on a Western target, perhaps?
That's the only thing that has motivated the United States to act so far. It has been the beheading of the Americans when the British citizens were killed. Those types of situations is what's causing motivation because it stirs public support within those countries. But if you're looking at a more large-scale response, it will take some sort of horrific event that occurs in some Western country that will trigger the type of public reaction where politicians have to respond. And I think in this case, it's going to be the public that's going to be driving the actions of the politicians, not the politicians looking at what needs to be done for the protection of the citizens.
That's political scientist Rick Brennan. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
In the 1920s and 30s, there was an explosion of African-American literature and music in New York City's Harlem neighborhood, known as the Harlem Renaissance. Earlier this month, New York audiences were able to hear an opera from that time by a composer you likely have not heard of, Harry Lawrence Freeman. It's called Voodoo. Jeff London has more.
About 8 years ago, as a grad student, Annie Holt was working at Columbia University's Rare Books and Manuscripts Library when she was assigned to catalog the work of Harry Lawrence Freeman, a largely forgotten Harlem-based composer from the early 20th century.
And it was fabulous. I had the honor of going through, you know, all the cardboard boxes that came right from his family's house and unearthing everything. And I, for myself, discovered how amazing his story was and how amazing his music is. In my opinion, and I've been really trying to get one of his operas produced since that time.
Holt is now artistic director of Morningside Opera, and she collaborated with Harlem Opera Theater and the Harlem Chamber Players to present two concert performances of Freeman's Voodoo. Holt says Freeman wrote both the music and the libretto for the opera, which is set on a Louisiana plantation after the Civil War.
And for me, that was a really interesting topic, especially looking at Freeman's historical moment during the Harlem Renaissance and the idea of African Americans reflecting upon racial identity in the 75 years after the Civil War.
Freeman was born in Cleveland, Ohio, just 4 years after the Civil War. He began to write operas when, at the age of 18, he heard German composer Richard Wagner's Tannhäuser. Freeman moved to Harlem in 1908, established both a music school and the Negro Grand Opera Company, and was a friend and colleague of the king of ragtime, Scott Joplin. He wrote over 20 operas in his lifetime. Harlem Opera Theater's artistic director Gregory Hopkins says while he hears Wagner's influence in Freeman's music, he hears a lot of other influences too.
Certainly you hear the colloquial music of the time. There's a cakewalk, there's a buck dance, there's even a voodoo dance. And you hear the interpolation of spirituals, which were so important to the development of the entire artistic tapestry of the Renaissance.
Steal away, steal.
The use of spirituals in the context of voodoo is very much plot-driven. The story is a classic love triangle between two women and one man. A spurned lover rejects her faith to use the magical powers of voodoo. She conjures a giant python and a magic tree, and even kills her rival, who is then revived miraculously by holy water, says director Melissa Crespo.
It's a battle of Christianity, and it's a battle of, you know, the voodoo magic at play, and, you know, which one is going to win. It's a big, giant story. Everyone has a lot of feelings, and they're feeling their feelings all over the stage. But that's the beauty of opera.
When Voodoo premiered on Broadway in 1928, it got some good notices in the African-American press, but the New York Times called it naive, and it was never performed again. It was very much of its time, including language audiences now find racist. And although Harry Lawrence Freeman may have been known during the Harlem Renaissance, his music was never published. Conductor Gregory Hopkins says that he and his collaborators hope that voodoo will resurrect Freeman's name.
I don't think the work or the composer will be obscure for too long.
For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
That's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The world's ocean produces 50 to 70% of our oxygen. It regulates our climate, absorbs carbon dioxide, supplies us with much of the protein we consume, and supports the greatest abundance of life on our planet. If the ocean were to disappear today, nearly all life on Earth would soon follow. Nonetheless, our ocean is under attack. As much as 40% of it is heavily affected by human activities that result in pollution, overfishing, and loss of coastal habitats. The ocean needs protection, and the United States and China, two of the top maritime nations in the world, as well as two of the global leaders in ocean science, have agreed to work together to do just that. On the marine environment, there is an urgent need for our countries to step up and help lead, said Secretary of State John Kerry during his closing remarks at the Strategic Track Oceans meeting. We have a real opportunity to deal with conserving and protecting the ocean, and we are already working together to address this, he said. During the meeting, Secretary of State Kerry and Chinese State Councilor Yang Jiechi agreed to combat illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing, expand cooperation among both countries' coast guards and maritime enforcement authorities, develop a Green Ports Initiative to reduce marine pollution, better monitor changes in the ocean and climate, and develop sister city and third country cooperation to reduce marine litter. Secretary of State Kerry, State Councilor Yang Jiechi, and leaders of U.S. and Chinese maritime agencies also discussed the importance of establishing a marine protected area in the Antarctic Ross Sea, one of the world's last remaining pristine marine environments. The United States and much of the international community have long sought to create a marine protected area in the Ross Sea. This 1.34 million square kilometer area, often referred to as the last ocean, is home to over 10,000 unique species, including penguins, whales, and colossal squid. The oceans are part of us, all of us, every country that borders the ocean, and so many countries that depend on fish for the protein that feeds their people, said Secretary Kerry. We need to heed carefully the responsibilities that we have.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.